I'm glad to note that somebody who formerly went to St. Benedict's College has introduced a man from Rochester College. Dennis and I found we used to go to different schools together. They were one another's chief rivals. The title of which I use this evening is perhaps a threatening one. I hope to try to trace, in brief, some of the changes that have gone on in the communications media and try to account for what I suppose most people know by now, that our, to account for the fact that our relationship to the typographical medium has considerably changed in the past few years. Persons who grew to maturity in the Western world before World War II were raised in a culture which regarded literacy as a test of one's ability to function as a full-fledged human being, to exercise full social responsibility. There was a kind of mystique or mythology of typography abroad up until pretty recent times, and it continues in its own way. But we should realize by now that the typographical era, which began some 500 years ago, is now drawing to a close, and that if it hasn't drawn to a close already, and that it was only one stage in a long and complicated development of communications, a development which goes far, far back into the past and certainly will stretch far, far into the unforeseeable future. Now, to see where we are, and possibly even to a degree where we're going, we have, of course, to see where we came from. And this means that we must go back to try to imagine what human life was like before literacy began. This is very difficult for us to do. We are likely to think of people before literacy as illiterate. This is a curious kind of concept, isn't it? Almost as bad as speaking of what they produce as oral literature. People have done this, and scholars continue to do it. But if you speak of oral literature, or even if you speak of the original human cultures before writing as pre-literate cultures, you're pretty much in the position of a person who would describe a horse as an automobile without wheels. You see, you can consider a horse as an automobile without wheels, but imagine writing a whole book in which about horses, in which you always refer to them as automobiles without wheels. It would be a rather curious, and I'm afraid a rather biased production. When we speak of these early cultures as illiterate, or refer to their performance as oral literature, as though what they said was a kind of mistake because somehow or other it never got down in writing, we're in this same position as one referring to a horse as an automobile without wheels. You take a second development, which is derivative from something earlier, and describe the earlier phenomenon as a negation of something that the second phenomenon has. Literature derives from an oral culture and not vice versa. It's very difficult then for us to imagine what an oral culture is like before the invention of any writing. It's a culture in which man is constantly losing intellectual contact with his past. Now note, I say intellectual contact because oral cultures certainly have massive contact with their past in an institutional way. Paleontologists tell us, for example, that in Neolithic cultures, you find stone axe heads or spear points tipped according to a certain design, And you find that one or another design will remain permanent without appreciable variation, not for 3 generations or 4 generations or 1,000 years, but for 10,000, 25,000 years. Imagine what the psychological structures must have been in a culture which could keep its members from experimenting with its stone implements that way. Now, this kind of culture really does possess its past, doesn't it? It does the way it performs the way it does because of the way the people in the same culture in the past perform. And this kind of conservatism is absolutely essential for early culture. It's not a defect, it's a great achievement. Why? Well, suppose, I guess we can suppose that other cultures allowed their members to tinker with the designs of some effective weapon that they had, with the result that they were eaten up by saber-toothed tigers. You see, when you achieve a kind of perfection in an instrument, and you don't have historical records, you don't have a science, you don't know quite how you got to doing it this way, nobody knows, and it works, you better stay with it. You see, in this situation, man is in contact with his past, but he is possessed by his past. When man becomes learned, he is in contact with his past in a new way, and he possesses it because he knows it intellectually. Earlier cultures are very much in contact with their past, but before a writing in an oral culture, they're not in contact with it in an intellectually reflective way. Oral cultures, then, do not know history as we know it. Reports of actual events must be gathered from eyewitnesses or near eyewitnesses. Events far distant in time, beyond the reach of living memory, are enshrouded in myth, in which they're virtually lost. Primitive man, before writing, has actually a history reaching back tens of thousands of years and more, but of almost all this he knows nothing. The American Indians, for example, didn't know where they had come from when the Europeans first came to our shores. And the Europeans didn't know much more. They knew where they'd just come from, and I suppose they hoped that they might be able to get back if necessary. But they had no idea how their ancestors had got to the particular place in Europe where they found themselves. The Europeans hadn't been literate long enough to find this out, because strangely enough, only with the development of literacy is the historical past, which was lost to earlier oral man, recovered once more. In an oral culture, one doesn't learn things by looking them up. This kind of world is perhaps virtually impossible for us fully to reconstruct. Try to imagine a culture where no one has ever looked up anything, or even thought of the possibility of looking up anything, where anyone was born or died or when, how many days in a year, who won a certain battle, what hour of the day it is. We take for granted, you know, that people know how many days there are in the year. Most people perhaps still don't. I don't know, but certainly they didn't used to. They knew when it was time to plant the crops because of certain manifestations in nature, and they could tell when the crops were ready to harvest. But then from the end of harvest until the time that they planted again was a vague period that they hadn't been able to count the days. They just didn't know, and many people still don't know, and of course they don't care. This kind of culture, then, is an oral culture and an aural culture, or a voice and ear culture. To find out something that one cannot observe in such a culture, you have to ask, and this means to ask a living person. Now, writing changed all this. It moved man forever out of the old oral, aural, or voice and ear culture. Script of any sort was a late development in human culture. And the most eventful of all scripts, the alphabet, was certainly the most difficult to come upon. If man's been on earth, say 500,000 years, to take a fairly firm figure, based on what we can puzzle out from the natural sciences, for almost all of his existence, he's had no real writing or script at all. Now, the making of visual representations of objects, pictures, paintings, clay, stone models, this sort of thing, is of course very old, and I'm sure we'll never find out what the beginnings of that is. Nobody's going to find out when the first man or woman drew the first picture. But script or true writing is more than picture drawing. Pictures essentially represent things or objects. By script, we generally mean, and I mean here, a system of representation focused on statements rather than on objects, on ideas and enunciations rather than on things. You might draw a picture and say just glass, if you can call a glass something made out of plastic. But if you're going to, if a script is able to say, this glass is tall, so that the person who looks at the visual representation knows that someone is saying that. That's quite a different thing from drawing a picture of a glass. One great incentive to the development of script is urbanization. Now, this is minimal urbanization. All you need is a few hundred people living together, or at any rate, a few thousand. When man began to live in sizable, compact, settled groups, record-keeping became necessary and the stage was set for true writing. The earliest script, which is the cuneiform writing of the Mesopotamian region, came into existence, so far as we can tell, I'm using Deringer's figures here, only around 3500 B.C. That's less than 6,000 years ago. Now, if man's been on Earth 500,000 years, you can subtract 6,000 from it without even subtracting your own margin of error. So it's nothing. As we might expect, there are many scripts with independent origins. Scripts in Mesopotamia, in Egypt, India, China. Chinese character writing, incidentally, is not the oldest character writing. Somehow Westerners seem to be under the compulsion to feel that China is older than every place else, but it isn't. In the Americas, you had other scripts among the Mayas and the Aztecs. These were rather late scripts. The Aztecs, the script was not developed until around AD 1400. But in all the experimenting with writing that was going on from around 3500 BC until the Aztecs developed their script around 1400, that is roughly a period of 5,000 years, the alphabet was hit on only once. This is very, very strange, isn't it? Certainly the most striking thing about the alphabet, there's only one alphabet in the entire world. The second most striking thing is certainly the vast number of scholars, even in language and literature, who are unaware of the fact that the alphabet was invented only once. I'm pretty sure that a good 90% of the members of the Modern Language Association of America do not know that the alphabet was invented only once. It isn't that anybody's arguing about it. It's patent fact, there are whole books about it, but it's just one of these things that doesn't come to the surface in conversations, in classrooms or elsewhere. We don't know who invented the alphabet, but we know the Phoenicians were carrying it around the Mediterranean region around the year 1500 BC, and that its beginning dates from around that time. Deringer speaks of a North Semitic and a South Semitic version. The Hebrew alphabet is a very early form of the alphabet, and all other alphabets of the world are derivative from something like the Hebrew form. The Greek alphabet used by the ancient and present-day Greeks, the Roman alphabet used by the ancient Romans and by ourselves, the Cyrillic alphabet, which in the 9th century St. Cyril and Methodius developed for the Eastern Slavic peoples and which the Russians use today, which is a very confusing thing, incidentally. I was in the Soviet Union briefly last summer and made it a point to learn the alphabet and a few expressions, and Greek is as much a hindrance as a help, because much of the Cyrillic alphabet is like Greek, but the evolution of the forms is a little bit different, and what looks like a capital Eta in Greek turns out to be an N in the Russian alphabet. The Sanskrit alphabet, the Arabic alphabet, the Korean alphabet, all these are derivative from the primitive Mediterranean alphabet. There was discovered not too many decades ago an alphabet at Ugarit in Mesopotamia, which superficially seems to be a separate derivation because the forms of the letters were so different. You see, in most alphabets, you can trace a connection between the particular alphabet and certain antecedents. For example, our Roman letter A looks like the Greek letter alpha, and that looks a good deal like the Hebrew aleph, doesn't it? But the Ugaritic alphabet was an alphabet made for writing in cuneiform style, the little wedge-shaped marks that you make when you use a stylus on soft clay. And it seems that the person or persons who invented it simply assigned sounds, so far as we can tell, more or less at random or arbitrarily, to different combinations of these little wedge-shaped marks. Well, yes, but when they list them, they go A, B, C, D, E, or A, B, G, D, something like that. You can tell from the way they handle these letters that the persons who used them knew the alphabet. They got the idea from the other Phoenician alphabet. Needless to say, the Cherokee alphabet or syllabary, developed by the famous American Indian Sequoia, was conceived of by analogy with the alphabetic writing in the European cultures with which the Cherokees had been in contact. Now, the fact that man had been so long without the alphabet, and that he invented it only once and never again, hints that it was desperately hard to come upon, doesn't it? Why should this be? I think we can sense why it should be if we'd only reflect upon the nature of sound. Sound is the base of all verbal communication, isn't it? Written words, printed words, are imitations of spoken words. But sound is of its very essence not merely perishable, but actually perishing, evanescent. Sound exists only when it is going out of existence. When I pronounce the word existence, by the time I get to the tenth, the exist is gone, isn't it? And it has to be gone, or you wouldn't understand me at all. This kind of thing used to worry St. Augustine, and I suppose it can worry us, but that's the way it is. Time marches on. Sound exists only when it's going out of existence. I cannot have all of a word present to me at once. This is not what a word is. It's not the kind of thing that can be present all at once. The human word is not. A moving picture can be stopped so that I can study a single frame closely. And it's advantageous to do this because visual perception is at its maximum when the field is quiescent. Isn't that right? When you want to see something clearly, you don't want motion. You want to stop it and study it as you study the running of a horse in a series of stroboscopic pictures that have been made in very quick succession. There's no way to do this with sound and still have sound. If I stop sound, a sound tape or a voice, suspended, all I have is utter silence, which is that out of which sound comes and into which sound again disappears. A word, one individual word, then can't be present to us all at once, much less can a longer utterance be present to us all at once. Now, to invent the alphabet We have to reduce this evanescence in time to permanence in space. We have to pretend what is not true, that this word can be present all at once, that it can be cut up into little parts, spatially conceived parts, and pretend that by joining these parts in space, one can reconstitute the word once more. The letters in a word can even be written backwards. I can, for example, write the letters in the word trap, and that order, so that they emerge in time on the board in that order, and yet I can pronounce them the other way, trap, although I wrote T-A-R-T. If you pronounce the word trap on a sound tape and reverse the sound tape, you don't get part as you do if you reverse the pronunciation of the letter. You just get a different sound. Because you see, you haven't reversed sound. You have on a sound tape, you have an electronic pattern which under certain specified conditions can be made to yield the word trap, the sound trap, and you simply reverse the movement of the electronic pattern. That is not a reversal of sound. It's a reversal of something in space. As a matter of fact, there's no effective way to think of reversing sound any more than there is an effective way to think of reversing time. We pretend that we can reverse something like time, as H.G. Wells does in The Time Machine. And it's very easy for us to pretend it in our technological culture because we like to project, and we almost immediately project, sound or time when we consider these reflectively onto a spatial field. We consider, you see, this minute on our watch as being next to the minute that went before. Now, if you take thought a bit and ask yourself, do I have any kind of impression in my consciousness of this minute that I'm living in now being next to anything? It isn't next to anything at all. That has nothing to do with it. But we make those immediate transfers. You see, we think of Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday as being next to one another on a calendar. Well, you have no impression at all, I'm sure. Today doesn't feel to you as though it were next to yesterday. You see, that has nothing really to do with our experience of time. The Hopi Indians approach it a little more directly if we can trust Benjamin Whorf. They speak of today as being yesterday come back again, only older. That's more like the real thing. Well, you see, this means then that there is something basically shaky about the sound-space relationship which the alphabet establishes or pretends to establish. It's not quite an honest arrangement. And all linguists know this. So no matter how you try, you cannot, with total accuracy, represent in the scribal characters what goes on when sound is being made. We're just beginning to know the kind of restructuring of the psyche that is brought about when children or adults are taught how to read, because this is a quite traumatic experience and a quite accurate sense of the word traumatic. But you'll say, don't pictures also reduce the evanescence of sound to permanent in space? Permanence in space. Suppose I draw a picture of a bird up here. Isn't this something permanent? Well, the picture is permanent, but the sound isn't. You see, all you've done when you produce a picture is represent a thing, and the sound that will be used in connection with that for a word depends upon the language the individual may be speaking. If I draw a picture of a bird, a Spanish person will call it un pájaro. And a French-speaking person will say, il est un oiseau. And a German-speaking person will say, das ist ein Vogel. really is. Chinese characters are like pictures, although they have a great number of incidental meanings built into them. They always remain pictorial. You've gone pretty far when you can draw a picture of however or nevertheless, and that's the sort of thing you can do in Chinese. But you draw a picture of something that reminds you of something, that reminds you of something, that reminds you of something, that reminds you of however. That's the way it works. Oh, there are all kinds of other complications, and they're very beautiful and intricate system, but it's not an alphabet. Although there are certain characters which become somewhat phonemic. Chinese characters are used by Japanese for their own Japanese words, words which are quite incomprehensible to Chinese. And the Japanese, who can't speak Chinese at all, can make out a good deal of what's going on in a Chinese newspaper. Although, if he said it, the Chinese wouldn't understand him any more than if he were speaking English. The alphabet's another story. It has nothing directly to do with pictures, although it apparently derives in some way from picture writing. The alphabet then operates directly on sound, but it operates on it spatially, pretending that the sound's present all at once, that you can cut it up into little spatial parts, and that you can reassemble these in any way you want to produce an indefinite number of sound patterns. Now, these thoughts give us some idea of how unusual the alphabet itself is as an invention, how strange it is, how weird it is, how it calls for man to think of speech in an utterly unnatural fashion. The invention of script produced, eventually, manuscript cultures which were dominated by writing. It took a long time to do this because, originally, script remained for hundreds of years just a kind of craft. There were certain people in society who could write, as there were certain people in society who could build a house or build a boat and so on. But gradually, in Greece, around the time of Plato, the culture became definitely what we might call a manuscript culture, so that the effects of literacy penetrated and began really to change social institutions and psychological structures. Manuscript culture became particularly powerful in societies using the alphabet. It's undoubtedly significant that it was in alphabetic societies that the real and effective demand for universal literacy first arose. But manuscript cultures, as we said, developed only slowly. The ancient Roman world, for example, knew the alphabet, but retained what to us is an incredibly strong voice and ear bent. The ideal of the liberal education of the ancient Greeks and Romans was to produce the rhetor, the orator, or public speaker. Reading was carried on quite commonly aloud, even when one read to oneself. Do you remember in St. Augustine's Confessions, he tells about how he came over from his native Africa to Milanus long before he was baptized. Remember, he was, 31 years old or so when he was baptized. And he came to Milan, however, to meet the great Ambrose, the Bishop of Milan, whom we now know as St. Ambrose. And Ambrose had been a rhetorician. This is why Augustine married him. And Ambrose, he tells us, was a very fine bishop. He kept open house all day long, as all bishops, I suppose, should do. Anybody could walk in on him anytime they wanted to. And St. Augustine said, I walked in one day, and there I found him reading to himself and not making any noise. Well, this shows, first, that sometimes people did read in antiquity without vocalizing it. But it also shows that if you found anybody doing this, it was unusual enough that you wrote it down in your diary, made note of the fact. Reading was carried on then quite commonly aloud, even when one read to oneself. Cicero, we know, also used to speak his orations first and write them in their finished form afterwards. In the case of the Catilinarian orations, almost certainly 2 years after they were delivered. It wasn't until the Middle Ages that manuscript culture in the West really began to come into its own. Even here, the oral approach maintained a great deal of strength in the medieval universities, for example. Once you got beyond the elementary stage, where the little boy had to learn the Latin in which all of his education was going to be conducted. For the very good reason, we must remind ourselves that there wasn't any other language to conduct it in. You had several thousand different languages in Europe, dialects, mostly mutually unintelligible, virtually none of them written. This is hard for us to reconstruct the situation, but even in Shakespeare's day in England, you couldn't say in English many of the things that were taught in universities. There was no vocabulary for it. There were no words. So once you got beyond learning the Latin language in which all your education was going to be conducted, there was no more writing required. Down at St. Louis University, as you know, we've got these microfilm manuscripts from Vatican Library, 11 million pages of them. Now, not all of them are medieval. Some of them come up into the present time. But millions of pages are medieval. And you can go through all those. You're not going to find any term paper anybody ever did at a medieval university, any written exercise you did, or any examination. People used writing. Teachers, the masters at the university, used writing for their notes. We have their lectures often written out, very likely after they gave them. The students took notes, of course, and as a matter of fact, got very bad times. The young instructors who were teaching in the College of Arts, who incidentally were mostly not theologians, but often medical students, they simply dictated to the class their course, and the class wrote it down, but they never tested them by writing. They apparently had not even thought of the idea that you could find out what a man knew by giving him a test in writing and extrapolating from that to get an idea of his whole knowledge. The boys and young men at the university proved their capability in logic, physics, psychology, as we can use modern terms that represent something of what they studied. Law, theology, yes, medicine too, by oral disputations, which were really highly organized debates. You proved that you could cure people by arguing down your opponent. They had the same attitude, you see, toward this oral performance that we have had toward literacy. We've had literacy tests. If you can pass the literacy test, this means that you're with it. You're able to function as a full-fledged member of the community. And so are them. If you could pass this oral test, you could do it too. But despite this persistent stress on the oral and aural, which makes them very oral by comparison with us, medieval men in Europe were still more devoted to manuscripts than any earlier culture had been. Medieval man was dependent on ancient Greece and Rome for much of his learning, as well as upon the Bible. And he used texts more assiduously than earlier man ever had. This was the culture that produced the bookworm. People like Petrus Comestor, the rector at the University of Paris in the High Middle Ages, whose name in English means Peter the Eater. And everybody knew that what Peter the Eater ate was not purple people, but books. It meant really Peter the Book Eater, and he liked the name. And really joyed when people, happy when people applied it to him. Now the bookworm or book eater might have existed from time to time in antiquity, but he was certainly not the cultural hero he was in the Middle Ages. In antiquity, Livy wrote his histories, remember, to be read to people out loud. It was the Middle Ages which, at their culmination, produced the art of printing. Medieval manuscript culture, I believe, made printing necessary, for printing is an effective way of producing in quantity what a manuscript culture wants, namely something to read. Often we think of printing as only this, a way of producing in great quantity, cheaply, with minimum effort, copies of books already in existence. But printing is much more than this. Printing changed man's very idea of what his own mental processes are. We can see how it did this if we reflect on how printing was a culmination of what happened when the alphabet was invented. It isn't sufficient to say that in the 15th century, movable type was invented. You see, they had movable type before. Before the invention in which Gutenberg took part. The Uyghur Turks had both the alphabet and movable type. The Koreans had both the alphabet and movable type, but it didn't occur to either of them to put one letter on one type. The Koreans, for example, had a type on which you had a Chinese character and then the equivalent in the Korean alphabet. That sort of thing. What happened was, in the 15th century, to describe the invention, what happened was there was invented a process of printing for movable type, which was cast from a matrix, which in turn was made by being struck with a punch. You started out by making yourself a punch in a hard metal, iron or an alloy of iron, some kind of steel. On the tip of the punch, you cut by hand a raised letter like the letter on a typewriter that strikes the platen. And after you'd cut these punches for all the letters of the alphabet, then you drove that punch into a bit of softer metal, generally a piece of brass, and you brought a still softer metal in molten state, an alloy of lead, because lead, if you use pure lead, it won't work. It shrinks when it cools and doesn't make a good clear type. You put a little antimony with it, and the alloy expands and fills out the mold sharply. You cast yourself a large number of types for each letter of the alphabet, put them over here in a case, and then you go to the case with your copy and a composing stick, compose the copy onto the stick, move the type from the stick onto a galley, prove it up on the galley, go take the proof back and correct the type on the galley by going back to the case of type, then move it from the galley onto a stone, lock it up in a case or a form on the stone, move it from the stone onto a printing press, bring ink rollers, or they used to use leather daubers in the old day, in contact with it, take them away, bring the paper in contact with it, bring the platen in contact with the paper, remove the platen, remove the paper, and then you've got something printed. But look how far you are from saying anything. What's more, you don't have to talk at all during the process. You don't have to know the language to be able to do this. In fact, you don't even have to be able to think. You can automate the whole thing. And this is being done and leading to such things as newspaper strikes today. You see, what's happened here is that the commitment of sound to space, which began with the alphabet, has become firmer and more complete. Now, with the invention of the alphabet, the spatialization of the word began to have its effect upon man's concept of his own thinking processes. But the fuller effect came only after alphabetic typography. It was type that made the real difference in this commitment to space. In antiquity and through the Middle Ages and much of the Renaissance, the workings of the mind had been studied in terms of logic. But logic had been more or less equated with dialectic and had been defined in Cicero's terms as the art of discourse. Logic was associated with rhetoric. It tended to be viewed as communicative, as social. You thought when you were talking to somebody, presenting something orally. After the invention of printing, however, logic came to be viewed more and more as the art of thinking, and thinking itself came to be regarded more and more as something one did, not in the living presence of another person, but inside one's own mind, outside of any social context, and even outside of any verbal context. If you carry this to its extreme, as many people are inclined to do, not realizing the consequences, this way of conceiving of thinking as something that's totally private suggests that in composing, we marshal first all our thoughts without any words. Then after we've got the thoughts all lined up, we go over here and get the words to match the thoughts. Now that's not the way you write a paper or work out anything else, is it? Words and thoughts are not exactly the same thing, but they're coefficients of one another. They're two sides of the same coin. For a human being, thinking is impossible without some kind of reference to language. After the invention of the alphabet in the 15th century, the state of verbal communications in the 16th and 17th centuries in Europe grows greatly confused. Renaissance humanists had made much of the culture of classical antiquity, and thereby had given a new status to rhetoric. The vast subject which dominated ancient Greek and Roman learning. As we've seen, the era just preceding the Renaissance had been very oral by comparison to us already. The Renaissance, by going back and resurrecting the old Roman ideal of the orator as the ideally educated man, increased this orality. Nevertheless, the culture in which humanism took shape made more of writing than any earlier age had. It was the Renaissance that invented modern textual scholarship, because once you had the printing press, you could develop this scholarship. If you copy things out in manuscripts, you're bound to multiply mistakes. You can gradually cut down on the number of mistakes if you use the printing press and use it carefully. We've said that by comparison with the classical antiquity, the Middle Ages were very much manuscript-oriented, text-oriented. And the Renaissance simply developed this text orientation further. The curious thing, isn't it, that this movement, which is supposed to have been a rebellion against the Middle Ages, turns out to establish itself by intensifying perhaps the most typical thing in medieval culture. This is the sort of thing that brings Herbert Butterfield to Cambridge to say that the Renaissance is the most medieval thing the Middle Ages ever invented. Printing, moreover, had affected the accumulation of facts even more than writing had. Knowledge was more than ever something one had to look up. Indexes became really feasible. Now, you can index a manuscript, and once in a while people do, but it's hardly worthwhile, is it? If you're in a medieval scriptorium like this room, and somebody's dictating a manuscript and all the monks are out here copying it, that's the way you multiply them, you wouldn't index those copies because the material would be on completely different pages in different manuscripts. You'd have to make a separate index for every manuscript in the room. It's not worth it. But once you have print with things locked in the safe, it's worthwhile spending 2 or 3 days making an index because it will go into 5,000 copies. Knowledge then became something not to recall, not to call to mind, not to recall, which is an oral concept, an orally based concept, but it became something, as we consider it today, to look up. Lists and compilations multiplied even beyond what they'd been in the Middle Ages. And they moved knowledge away from utterance to tabulation. Early humanists, such as Erasmus, made collections of adages and apophthegms, that is, of saying of what men had said, like the Book of Proverbs, the saying of Solomon and so on. But later compilers moved away from making compilations of sayings and tended to compile facts. But 16th and 17th century educators and thinkers were really not quite aware of the great revolution that was going on in their world, any more than we are today aware of the revolution that we're taking part in. In effect, you can say the Renaissance humanists continued to behave and talk as though they were training Latin orators, when as a matter of fact, they were training vernacular writers. But they never seemed to have noticed that fact. By the 18th century, the typographical age had had a kind of maximum effect upon man's approach to his own mental processes. Theories of communication and language are highly spatial and diagrammatic in the 18th century. The universe itself became curiously silent. Earlier cosmologies had conceived of the world in terms of the harmony of the spheres, a concept which goes directly with the Aristotelian idea of the universe. And of course, we remember in the Psalms how day calls today and night calls tonight. This is very much a part of the Hebrew equipment. You find a fine treatment of this in Leo Spitzer's book, classical and Christian ideas of world harmony. These were not just poetic, metaphorical ideas frosting on the cake, but part of the real cosmology of the earlier time. By the 18th century, the universe was silent, and people like Joseph Warton comment on this. Right in the very 18th century itself, they speak about the silent universe. The 18th century emerges as the great age of deism, when God himself becomes silent in man's way of conceiving him. Many persons, following the recipe they used for man, considered God not any longer as a revealer, someone who tells men something, not as a communicator, but as that most 18th century concept of all, the great architect, a kind of supernatural beaver. God's creative activity tended to be thought of as something like a process of piling bricks on one another, or he became a force, if you want, as though this were somehow or other a better thing than someone who spoke. Men tended to forget the primacy of the vocal, the oral, the aural, in that one Genesis account of creation where we read that God said, let there be light, and there was light. The kind of text that Lutherans really like very much, I know. The oral and aural world of primitive man had been lost in preoccupation with locomotion in space and with observation, which operates primarily by vision, to reports on phenomena in space. But this age, which was initiated in the 15th century with the invention of printing and brought to maturity in the 18th century, the typographical age, has proved to be only another stage in the larger movement of development in communication. It's being succeeded in our day by the electronic age, and this age is moving in a curious way into a world of sound once more. But it's a new world of sound. It's not moving back, because backward movement is impossible. But in moving ahead, we're somehow or other breaking through a new frontier of sound. Marshall McLuhan likes to say we live in a global village. But you see, that's a paradox. Most people don't notice that. If it's global, it's not a village. If it's village, it's not global. That's the kind of, that's not an explanation, but something to tease you with. Voice in a different way now is coming into its own. Letters used to bear messages from people who were separated geographically from one another. Now telephones supplant or supplement letters, making persons immediately present to one another in voice. Recordings, phonographic or tape recordings, give a weird new currency to sound. They make sound marketable as printed, and really, it doesn't really sound as marketable, though, in this case, even as it is. It's the electronic pattern that's marketable. It's interesting that telephones and many of our still newer communications media, including sound tapes, there's this public address system here, these things operate through the activities of electrons which no one will ever be able to see. We know that these are sub-visible particles. Radio serves much the same purpose as telephone. It's a purely aural, voice and ear device, and even television is largely a sound device. It's radio with pictures added. You know, you can read just as well on television as in the paper. You can read a weather chart, but that isn't the way they give it to you on television. When they put a weather chart on television, there's always the pretty young girl or the sage old meteorologist to talk you through it. Television uses relatively few of the devices commonly associated with the visual aids for teaching, charts, diagrams, and the like. It uses lots of panel discussion, much more than radio, because radio can give you a fireside chat, an address from one person or maybe two. In television, the sound serves to keep apart a large number of persons so you can listen to a large panel or group discussion. Rapid transportation is a vocal communications device in great part. It encourages communication by direct confrontation of persons, that is, by voice, by sound. Today, more than ever before, people come together from all over the country and all over the world to talk, to hear talk, to discuss their problems. The national and international convention, political, educational, business, religious, is no longer the rarity it had to be in the past. It's a dominant phenomenon of our age, an age reawakened to the possibilities of vocal exchange. The discussion groups which exist by the thousands across the country are not a typical present-day phenomenon. We describe our culture as technological. You could just as well describe it as a meeting culture or a convention culture. That's just as typical. You say, well, they had a few meetings in earlier days, well, they had a little technology in earlier days, too. But by no means the sort of thing we have. In other areas, too, sound has come into its own. Sonar is actually used to catch sardines and other fish. And the direct application of sight is on its wane in science. Lens telescopes are being supplemented or even supplanted by radio telescopes, which tell us much more than the older purely sight instruments could. Our orbiting satellites beep information back to us long after they're out of range of our sighting instruments. The study of language itself is undergoing a tremendous revolution today. Grammar has long been the old standby of those whose measuring stick is literacy. Grammar, as you know, the root of the word out of which our term grammar is built, is simply the Greek word for a letter of the alphabet. I'm saying gramma here, not gamma, not alpha, beta, gamma, delta, but gramma, which means a letter, any letter of the alphabet. Grammar is based primarily on the study of the written word. Studying grammar is studying letters, to put it in plain English. We might define grammar even as an attempt, largely unsuccessful, to get people to speak the way they ought to write. Today, however, grammar is only one tiny part of the much larger science of linguistics, which is the study of the word at first hand, not at one remove, the spoken word. The spoken word is, of course, a much more difficult thing to study than the written word because it's much richer. There's more to it. It exists in some kind of existential context, not the kind of abstraction that writing is. In philosophical circles, the interest in logic has given way in many quarters to a new interest, not the old interest in dialectic, but a related interest in dialogue, in knowledge held in a context of conversation. We now study the sociology of thought, the way thought develops in a communal context. In theology, which has made such great strides in our day, a parallel development has taken place, but a paradoxical one. You all know how much the progress of present-day theology has depended upon scriptural study. And this seems to give the lie to what I'm saying, doesn't it? Because here you do have a phenomenon where progress is being made by working on the written word. Just to take a closer look. Modern biblical study is paradoxical because most of the greatest progress in biblical study has come from the newly acquired knowledge of the oral tradition which lies back of the Bible itself and out of which the Bible emerges. This is what has given modern scriptural study life, isn't it? The oral world produces not only the Old Testament, but the New as well. Jesus could read and write. We know this from instances in the Gospels themselves, but he left no writing of his own. We might ask why. My answer would be it would be too inaccurate. I mean, the way he did it is the more accurate way to transmit the Gospel. We can talk about that later. The very texture of our Lord's thought is that of an oral culture, because oral cultures determine not only expression but also thought. Remember, you know what you can remember, what you can recall, what you can recover. So an oral culture learns the kinds of things that can be memorized. And the kinds of things that can be memorized, not in the way we memorize by looking at a sheet and reading off words and memorizing word for word, but memorizing in terms of formulas and themes. The kinds of things that can be memorized or retained, and if somebody has thoughts of the sort that can't be memorized, they simply go down the drain. And late as our Lord came In the history of writing, the culture still is largely oral. So we get such things as the Beatitudes. Blessed are the poor of spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are the meek, for they shall possess the earth. You see this pattern of correspondence? It gives you a kind of formulaic basis on which you can recall things. The same kind of pattern you find in the Psalms, isn't it? And of course, there's a deep, deep message underneath even the oral expression there. It's the message of correspondence. If you have this, then you have that. Things aren't in chaos. There's one thing corresponds to another thing. There's a time to eat and a time to sleep. It is a very deep message conveyed even under the word. The Gospels themselves, though they're written down very shortly after Jesus' life, echo the oral preaching and teaching of the apostles and other early members of the church in which the Gospels had their origin. And you can take even works such as the Epistles of St. Paul, which are obviously written compositions, and find great amount of oral elements in them. In another way, too, theology makes fruitful use of the oral, that is, through its cultivation of dialogue, which has begun to unite disparate groups, as earlier orality, which was devoted to dialectical polemics, had once divided them. Dialogue, too, has opened the way to greater religious secular understanding. Thus, you see, with all this new implementation of the vocal, there is a sense in which it appears that the age of literacy has ended. And yet, as we think of the possibilities of preaching the gospel and bringing Christ's message to the world today, we must remember that we still have to be literate as never before, because the new media do not destroy the old, but paradoxically often reinforce the old. When man first began to write, he didn't stop talking. In fact, you can make out a pretty good case that the men who wrote probably talked more than the ones who didn't, because they lived, as we've seen, in urban settings. And I'm pretty sure that people in urban settings talk a good deal more than people in more rural environments. So man, with the invention of writing, speech both lost and gained in importance. It lost because it no longer monopolized the field, but it gained because it was something which could now be put into writing. It could be given a kind of permanence which it didn't have before. It's entirely likely that the invention of writing brought man then to speak more. When typography was invented, man didn't cease writing. Typography actually reinforced writing, because it wasn't until after the invention of print that the demand for universal literacy really became effective. After print was invented, it really became important that everybody be able to read and to write, not to print, though. So today, with the arrival of the electronic media of communications, printing gives no real signs of going out of existence. Printing and the literacy which goes with it have both lost and gained in importance. They're no longer so uniquely central as they once were. They become part of a much larger complex featuring the electronic media, which gives human communication a new organization hitherto unknown. So with this background, I hope now that we can get into some questions about how this applies to the actual problems of the church and of theology today. I have not treated much theological material here directly, because I believe to see our present situation is necessary to have this kind of cultural background. So if you have any questions, well, I'd be happy to entertain them now. Yes. Yeah. Yes, there's no doubt about that. You can look it up in things such as Deringer's work, or if you look at my own book, The Presence of the Word, I've got a bibliography on that. There's no dispute about it. I know you're thinking the Korean alphabet doesn't look like it at all. It looks like little bubbles coming out of Coca-Cola straws or something like that. Yes. Yes. Yeah.